for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Former President Bill Clinton says the work of Paul Farmer should be recognized by a Nobel Prize. The medical anthropologist has dedicated his life to making healthcare a human right, and now his book brings a new generation into the fight for global health equity. It's titled To Repair the World. Paul Farmer joins me from a studio at Harvard University. You're welcome to be part of the conversation. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you, Dr. Farmer. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Diane.
Good to have you with us. I know how busy a man you are. Is it true that you're currently living in Kigali, Rwanda?
Well, I've been between Harvard, Kigali, and Haiti over the past few years.
Tell me about what you are seeing in Haiti most recently.
Well, I just got back from Haiti this morning, and so I can... What I just saw was a new teaching hospital that, together with our partners in the Haitian Ministry of Health and partners from all over the world, a lot of them from Partners in Health, of course, we opened this beautiful new teaching hospital, and it is spectacular, and it is designed to actually address those healthcare disparities you mentioned in your intro. So I've seen a lot of good things happen recently, and that one most colossal among them.
You know, it surprised me when I saw films of that hospital, because what we have seen most recently in terms of photographs or films of that country has been the ongoing poverty, has been those living still in tent cities. And here in the midst, as you just said, this gleaming new facility.
Well, it is a contrast experience, because that hospital is designed to take care of the very people you mentioned, those who are left behind by progress, who are still facing extreme poverty and illness at the same time. And, you know, we have a long way to go, and we don't delude ourselves into thinking that a hospital or any other healthcare delivery institution is going to single-handedly lift people out of poverty. At the same time, we believe that it can, an institution like that and the teaching that can happen inside of it can help break that cycle of poverty and disease that we see in images very often from
How was the money raised to build that facility?
The money was raised by private donations from people across the world, especially the United States, some within Haiti as well, from companies and corporations that donated in kind, for example, the information technology, the IT backbone of the hospital from Hewlett-Packard, et cetera. And but there were also union laborers from the Electricians Union here in Boston, Painters Union, Carpenters Union, who donated their time and skills not just to build that hospital but also to train Haitians how to learn these crafts, these trade crafts. So it really was a teaching hospital all through its construction as well, and not just now that it's open. And again, the other thing I'd add is those were private donations, but it's built as a public hospital.
And how many U.S. physicians, how many Haitian physicians will be involved? Or put it more broadly in terms of the employees themselves?
Sure. Well, we've been working in Haiti for almost 30 years, and our MO has been to have the employees of Partners in Health and its sister organization in Haiti, which is Amis de la Santé, be Haitian. So that's been another a major part of any success we may have had has been by focusing on job creation and local capacity building. And we've taken the same model to Rwanda. You mentioned Rwanda in your intro. The last 10 years, Malawi, Lesotho, everywhere we work in Peru, et cetera. This teaching hospital follows that general pattern, but brings in subspecialists in fields of clinical medicine, nursing, hospital administration, and some of the maintenance of the complex systems in a hospital has brought in people with that expertise if it doesn't exist in Haiti. Sometimes the expertise is brought in by members of the Haitian diaspora who are coming back to help on projects like this. But it's still going to go in the same direction of local capacity building and creation of possibilities to provide high-quality medical services by Haitians for other fellow Haitians.
The goal implied in the title of your book seems pretty lofty, to repair the world. Paul Farmer speaks to the next generation. Talk about what you mean by repairing the world.
Well, at first I feel like I should apologize if the title seems a little over the top, but it's meant sincerely. The world is, you know, a broken place in many senses, and anybody who looks back on the history of our nation or any other knows it. I mean, again, I've worked in places like Rwanda, in Guatemala after a brutal civil war and genocide, and Peru at the tail end of a civil war. And I've had the privilege of being in Haiti for all these long years, and also in the United States with people who are displaced by these large-scale social forces and historical events that you could see in Boston just as in Navajo Nation. So I don't think broken is the wrong metaphor, but it also seems eminently possible to repair brokenness or make amends for it, and in fact do a better job thinking about equity, justice, even in an arena such as clinical medicine. We can do a better job. And so that was the aspiration. The part about the next generation, of course, I'm a teacher. I'm speaking to you from Harvard Medical School. And that's how we see a sustainable future, is working with the next generation to talk about not only what we've learned, but errors that have been made in the past, mistakes that have been made in the past, and to try to do a better and thus reparative job. So that was the basic thinking in collecting these essays.
You talk in these essays about health as a human right, and you say it's been plagued by failures. What do you mean?
Well, I can certainly speak of personal failures, and did on Sunday at this great celebration in the town of Mirbalé. I just remembered three of the young people that I had worked with when I was a young man in Haiti in the early and mid-80s. We had started a small group to work on a community health project, and there were six or seven of us. And within a few years, three of that group were dead. None of them saw 30 years of age. One died of an infection after childbirth. Another of cerebral malaria, misdiagnosed as a mental illness. And a third died in great pain of a perforated ileum after getting typhoid. So that's like half of our team. So when I think about failures, I do think about our own failures, mistakes that are made. And I think that we can't say that the idea of health as a human right, or these basic services, clean water, for example, as a right, in no regard has any of that been an unqualified success, not in the countries where I work, including my own. And there are other paradigms beyond the rights-based paradigms that are important, too. And they also support the notion that investments in these basic social services like healthcare and education will yield development, stability, safety, et cetera. So I think the rights paradigm is important because it reminds us to think hard about social protection for the poorest. Because if, you know, people say that it's not feasible or cost-effective to provide care for the most vulnerable and the frailest, then we have to go back to these rights networks. I listened to the end of your last show and heard people talking about community-based care and home-based care for the elderly, the frail elderly, in this country. We've got a long way to go, and we've actually learned some things in places like Haiti and Rwanda that could help us move towards the aspiration of the right to good health care here as well.
And yet, here in the richest country in the world, there are many without any health coverage whatsoever. The president's plan for overall health care has finally passed in a much reduced form, and yet there are still those working to overturn it, that many believe that health care is a personal, individual responsibility and that the government itself should have absolutely no part in it. So as we talk about health care around the world, we also have to talk about health care in this country. Paul Farmer's new book, To Repair the World. Short break here and right back. And if you've just joined us, Paul Farmer is co-founder of Partners in Health. He's also chair of the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. He's just written a new book. It's a collection of essays titled To Repair the World. Paul Farmer speaks to the next generations. And Dr. Farmer, I know that you established Partners in Health. You co-founded it back in 1987 when you were still a student in medical school. One of our emailers, Christopher, says, Paul is a hero of mine. I've read much of his work. At times, he seems to struggle between anger at the structural aspects of poverty and the opportunity to provide health equity. I'd like to know what motivates him to do this work and the mixture of positive and negative experiences. Dr. Farmer.
Well, thank you, Christopher, for the question. I mean, the joy and positive parts of this are pretty easy and pretty straightforward to understand. When you can deliver effective quality health services to people who are facing illness or injury, these days you can get really good results. People get better. I certainly, as someone who has been here in Boston for a long time, I can't help but think, and said so in Haiti this weekend, that in the Boston Marathon bombings, nobody who reached a hospital died. And that's because we have, even with all the deficiencies of our national health system, we have excellent teaching hospitals and some safety nets that could move the injured if very quickly and efficiently to hospitals like the one I trained and work in, the Brigham and Women's Hospital. And that there's even in the face of tragedy and illness and suffering and pain, seeing patients receive good care and consolation and expert mercy is very uplifting. I can't think of anything more satisfying than just being in a modern teaching hospital in the middle of central Haiti, the same town, by the way, where those three young people I mentioned earlier lived and died. And, I don't know how useful anger is or any other emotion, but I think it is outrageous that there are people in the world today, in fact, hundreds of millions of them, living on, such tiny amounts of money, living and dying, not having access to education, to primary, secondary, or tertiary education, not having access to clean water. I think it's outrageous. It's distressing. It's not the way things should be. It's something broken that needs fixing. And cultivating joy and satisfaction in the face of adversity is a very worthwhile pursuit, I have no doubt. But I think there's also an illusion that these are that in an earthquake, for example, in Haiti, that it's a natural disaster. It's also a social disaster. I mean, nobody believes really in the United States that Katrina and what it revealed was just the result of bad weather and Hurricane Katrina, I'm referring to. So that's why we should have some high emotion around these issues as well, because they're really social artifacts as much as anything else, and we can fix them. That's the good news. Again, back to the positive, joyous thing. I don't mean to get too philosophical on your listening audience, but I think it's a natural, at least it feels natural to me, way of shuttling between optimism and pessimism, and tough analysis and intervention that is all, very satisfying when it's effective.
How do you take care of yourself and those around you when you're in the midst of an area that may be populated so heavily by those who are really desperately ill?
Yeah. Well, that's a great technical question. And, just to get very specific on first, the nature of a threat to the staff is based on what's going on, obviously, in the clinic or hospital or village or town or squatter settlement, whatever it may be. The biggest problem that we face in that regard is tuberculosis. Not just in the southern reaches of Africa, but even in our work in Haiti, in Rwanda, and in Siberia and Peru. We're working a lot in prisons, hospitals, clinics, institutions where you really need to address that risk, which is often invisible because it's airborne disease and you can't really tell when someone has been infected. And the best way to protect ourselves as providers, I think that's what you meant by the question.
Yes.
Is to make sure there's good infection control for everybody. And that's not easy to do. In this new hospital, what we've done is to bring in some methods that are fairly straightforward. For example, having open courtyards, decreasing the number of walls and windows, having air move through, fans, overhead fans that move the air, ultraviolet lights that kill the organism that causes tuberculosis. And in some of the areas of the hospital which need to be closed, like an operating theater, or the block of operating theaters, with filters that pull out the air. And so those are a mix of what some people would think of as high-tech and low-tech interventions. And we've been able to do that, though, in Africa as well, in the places we work.
But now, back up to 1987 and the founding of Partners in Health, what did you hope to achieve by founding that organization, and how far do you believe you've come?
Well, thank you for asking that. I mean, we were mostly young. I was 27 in 1987, so, you know, you look back, and we did, and say, well, what did we define as our mission statement? And I think our mission statement is pretty cool. It says that we're going to make a preferential option for the poor in healthcare. That was a notion borrowed from theology. But it also says we're going to do that by linking elite medical centers, and we changed that to academic medical centers, to the problems that we're seeing in places where there aren't modern medical facilities. And again, this weekend is an example of that. It's not just a hospital in Haiti. It's a teaching hospital. It links places like the Harvard teaching hospitals, including the Brigham, which I mentioned, to Central Haiti and other universities. We've done that in Rwanda as well. So it's actually the mission was fairly specific. And how well are we doing? Well, I think we're meeting a lot of those goals. It's taken a long time, it seems to me, 25 years. And we're just one of many groups probably working toward this goal. But in the last few years alone, we've seen a lot of academic medical centers, for example, go with us to Rwanda to work with the Ministry of Health to build medical and nursing capacity that just never existed in Rwanda, even before the genocide in 1994. I think the same thing is happening in many of the other places we work as well. So we have a long way to go because we're interested in health equity globally, not just in one country or one place. But I think the people who founded Partners in Health, who are still with us, are proud of progress made.
And here's an email from Carol in Columbia, Maryland, who says, if the goal is to keep doctors where they are most needed, what's to stop them from going to the U.S. or elsewhere as money and prestige tempt them?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, a lot of people call that the brain drain, right, in medicine and nursing. And, you know, I was in Malawi and Lesotho in January, and Partners in Health is working again with the local health authorities. And people were saying, well, there are probably more nurses in Manchester, England, than there are Malawian nurses in Manchester than in Malawi. And the brain drain, there's two ways to think of it. One is, how do you keep professionals from leaving their countries, which is not the way I would recommend doing it? Or the other way is, how do you keep them where they're needed in their countries? A lot of these professionals have been trained on the public dime, you know, in Haiti, Rwanda, Malawi, Lesotho, and there's enormous need. And if they were to make a preferential option for the poor in healthcare, they'd stick right in their home communities. But keeping, you know, preventing people from moving around freely is not the best way to do it. How can we keep them? Make sure they're paid adequately, that they have good working environments. You mentioned already, Diane, that, you know, there's enormous risk to healthcare workers from epidemic disease, and tuberculosis is the main one. How do we make sure that they're protected and safe in their work environments? And then how can it be a teaching and learning environment? So we've been focusing not on the pull forces, pull them back to or keep people in these working in these situations, because the work is enjoyable and satisfying and uplifting and has joy in it. And let me tell you, when you're a nurse or a doctor and you're sitting in some you know, poor quality medical infrastructure where the electricity is going out, you don't have internet, you don't have the medicines, it's dirty, it's stank, it smells bad, and there are 200 people waiting in line to see you. Mm. Nobody can take that for long. And it's not a way to deliver good medical care, and it's certainly not a way to retain people. So, Carol, I don't know if I answered your question, but we're very focused on creating good working conditions for young professionals and not so young professionals.
What does that mean in terms of the evolution of your own involvement in these various projects around the world? Are you constantly on the road? Are you staying in one place for months? How do you manage?
Well, I'm not necessarily doing exactly what I like the most, which would be sitting in place and providing care. I feel like it's my turn to actually try and create those kind of possibilities for many other people. So, in other words, finding the resources and pulling people together to build healthcare institutions and healthcare systems occupies increasingly my time, as does teaching.
In other words, raising money.
Raising money and commitment also. You know, we talk about accompaniment in our work. It's not just money, it's long-term commitment. And in Rwanda, for example, when I started there 10 years ago, spent a lot of time in direct clinical work with my colleagues, many from Partners in Health, some from the Rwandan Ministry of Health. And in the last few years, I've been more focused on understanding successes and failures that we've had in working with the public authorities to build health systems and just thinking about national health systems. It's not always the most enchanting part of the work for me, but I think it's been very rewarding.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to open the phones and take a few calls before the break. First, let's go to Greenville, South Carolina. Good morning, Joey. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'd like to ask Mr. Farmer here what he feels about religion's role in healthcare and, you know, the challenges that come along in places like Haiti and even here in the United States, when we have such a strong tie with, you know, the right and the Republicans and Christians opposing healthcare, when if you really look at Jesus' ministry, for example, it was very much about compassion and helping people. What would you say to this?
Well, I think the word is roles, right? You said it yourself, Joey, that there's very disparate ideas about what the role of faith should be in attending to the kind of problems that we see. And when I say see, I mean see in a clinic, if people are lucky enough to get in a clinic or hospital, but you see it everywhere where there's poverty and inequality. I think, you know, the founders of the church you mentioned are pretty clear on that. That's where the whole term preferential option for the poor comes from. It comes from the notion that there are these so-called corporal works of mercy. They feed the hungry, you know, clothe the naked, you know, visit the prisoners, et cetera. It's very pretty straightforward, if you ask me. And so the idea of religion having a role to block those kind of corporal works of mercy and acts of justice, I know why I call that religion. I mean, it's some other phenomenon that, but I'm not sure that it squares with Christian theology. I mean, I'm not that familiar. Actually, to repair the word, the title of the book comes from Jewish philosophy and theology. But I think the ideas underpinning a lot of the world, the religions that are really very clear on social justice for people who are poor, vulnerable, marginalized, you know, rejected, sick, injured, and that I think can be a great inspiration and is indeed to many who do this work. Many of them are inspired by their understanding of, you know, what the Good Samaritan did It didn't go to help someone he knew. He went to help a complete stranger. And you know, I don't want to sound Pollyannish, but that's how I read what religion's role should be, which is to support acts of mercy and justice.
And just to elaborate, we've had an email from someone who says repairing the world is a translation of Tikkun Olam, a Hebrew phrase that means repairing or healing the world, suggesting humanity's shared responsibility to heal, repair, and transform the world. We'll take a short break in our conversation with Dr. Paul Farmer. When we come back, more of your calls, your comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the John A. Hartford Foundation, working to improve the health of older Americans, at jhartfound.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, evidence that some criminals may have biochemical or neurological irregularities that make them more prone to commit violent crime. We talk with criminologist and psychiatrist Adrian Raine, the first researcher to do brain imaging studies of murderers. His new book is called The Anatomy of Violence, The Biological Roots of Crime. Join us.
Welcome back. If you've just joined us, Paul Farmer is with me. He is joining us from Harvard University, where he's chair of the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine and the author of To Repair the World. Paul Farmer speaks to the next generation. Right now, he's speaking to you, and if you have a question or comment, join us by phone, email, follow us on Twitter or Facebook. Let's go to Sarasota, Florida. Good morning, Kathy. You're on the air.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here. My question is this. You know, we talk about social responsibilities to the sick and the poor, admirable qualities, and certainly qualities that come with the Christian religion as well as others. And yet we have politicians, especially on the right, who profess to be Christians, but they counter the needs of those most vulnerable in our country, that it's socialism. And, you know, I think that's a poor excuse. And, you know, how do you counter that?
Well, you know, when I hear that, I generally try to think, why is someone saying, you know, what is this person's point? You know, I kind of actually try to think like a doctor more than anything else. What is the need of this person to say that? I mean, is this someone who wants to have a discussion about how to deliver services to the vulnerable and the sick, or is it someone who doesn't want to have that discussion and is really trying to cut off the conversation? You know, there's almost always some ideological posturing going on or point that's trying to be made. You don't hear those kind of comments very much in a clinic, a hospital. I've never heard it really in Haiti in the work we do, or in Rwanda, Malawi, et cetera. It's more of a political and sociological discussion. I don't want to use cop-out terms. I'm just saying usually people don't have any real clear definition of what they mean by socialism.
And so, just to follow up on that, here's an email from Susanna who says, my concern in accepting the premise that healthcare is a right is that it seems to imply the corollary that healthcare should also be free. But if people start to believe that healthcare should be free, think of the impact on healthcare providers. Will they become slaves of a sort, or vastly underpaid, non-autonomous workers? My personal belief is that this cost should be spread amongst all members of the public through sound tax policy, but it should never, ever be promoted as free. How do you respond to that, Dr. Farmer?
Well, first of all, healthcare is never free, right? It always costs something to deliver good services, just as in education or clean water, et cetera. So, and second of all, the emailer makes a point. She said that healthcare costs should be shared by all. That's called insurance, right? And a regressive insurance policy says you're sick, you pay. And a progressive insurance policy says, you know, it's when you're sick that you shouldn't have to worry about how healthcare financing is established. That's not when you want someone like going back to the Boston Marathon bombings. You don't want anybody who's injured to have to worry about the nature of healthcare financing in the city of Boston on a day like that.
And surely no one is going to ask on a day like that when one's leg is partially or wholly severed, do you have insurance before
that's
I
take right.
you?
That's right. And, you know, and that's a, these events like an earthquake or an attack like the one here, they're reminders of the vulnerability of all of us. And I don't think you're necessarily disagreeing with me, the emailer. I'm sorry I didn't catch your name, but that no one who really does this work or has to raise resources, find people, do it, ever really believes it's free. The question is, how should healthcare be financed? And there are exceptions, or there are many instances in which it's not wise at all to have the sick to pay out of pocket for their health care. I'll go back to the example of tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is an airborne disease. It's a public health threat. And guess who it affects most of all? The poor. So if you say, well, we know that health care isn't free, we know it costs money, and we're going to have the patients pay out of pocket when they're sick with tuberculosis, that's a recipe for failure. You don't find the patients, you don't diagnose them correctly, and you don't get them in care, nor do you keep them in care. So it fails on every front. Patient-based financing of tuberculosis care. Again, same with AIDS. When AIDS surpassed tuberculosis to become the leading infectious killer of young adults in the world, there were no programs, no plans to have healthcare delivery available to the great majority of those who needed the care most. There was no healthcare financing scheme. And Then came along some big programs, one of them from the U.S. government, which is called President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. That's the largest intervention for global health history in the history of the world.
So and is it
made
all
treatment available?
Is it all, in your view, in the hands of politicians? Is it all going to come down to the decisions they make from the right, the center, or the left about who gets health care and how much?
My guess is that the majority of what comes to pass will end up being decided in policy circles, yes. There are community-based health insurance schemes. For example, we have been involved in establishing those with our partners in Rwanda. Most people, the great majority of people in Rwanda have community-based health insurance now. Much more than the greater fraction are insured in Rwanda than in the United States, which is pretty startling. That was linked to a nationwide policy that was rolled out on the district and village level. Now, I'm not pretending to be an expert on health insurance schemes, but it seems clear to a physician who's interested in this question and working in several countries in the world that all of those countries have had to face this question of how to develop policies if they want to deliver even the most rudimentary healthcare services to the great majority. And I don't see any escaping it. And it often is in the hands of political decision makers.
All right.
Of course, they're elected.
You mentioned earlier the Boston Marathon bombings. There has been a tweet from the Boston Police Department saying only that 3 more suspects are in custody and more details will follow. Here's an email from Susan in Arlington, Virginia. She says, I understand you have been highly influenced by liberation theology. Is that true? And if so, could you please say how the specific aspect of that particular strain has informed what you do?
Well, I mean, it is true. That's certainly true. And it's a very interesting question. You sound like an infectious disease doctor. How has that strain influenced you? Going to Haiti when I was 23 years old and seeing a lot of things that I'd never seen before, having rarely been out of the United States after growing up in Florida, I saw a lot of suffering, and I mentioned already some of the ways that touched all of us personally because of losing people who we worked with of eminently preventable or treatable disease and other misfortune and injury, and of course that would only, you know, will only occur more over the years as one spends more time in settings that are vulnerable. You can see more of it. I just found it very useful to me, this notion of a preferential option for the poor, which I cribbed directly from liberation theology and specifically from the work of Gustavo Gutierrez, who I later met in Peru, his native Peru, and have become good friends with. We actually just finished a book together about this topic. But I would add one thing, that illnesses also make a preferential option for the poor. You know, AIDS, tuberculosis, cholera, even, you know, cancers, diabetes. There is a trend, there's increased burden of disease, not just from infectious diseases, but from non-communicable diseases as well, among the poor. And that seems like perhaps an obvious point, but it was helpful to me to think that if that were the case, how could we direct more of our attention as a profession of medicine, nursing, et cetera, most of our attention, in fact, to the poor? That's what a preferential option of the poor in healthcare means. So it is true. There are, all, of course, Partners in Health is a secular organization, not a religious one. And many people who are themselves not interested in Christian theology or other kinds of theology nonetheless find themselves inspired by some of these notions of, again, preferential options for the poor, and also what some of us have called structural violence. That is, there's a kind of violence that you see in a genocide like Rwanda 1994, or the military coups that we've seen in Haiti and elsewhere we worked, or in the Boston Marathon bombings. That's event violence. It happens. Things, you know, blow up right in front of you. And yet there are other kinds of violence, too. There's violence that people living in poverty or marginalized by gender inequality or racism face every day. And it plays itself out in healthcare. So those notions have all been helpful to us as we try to understand our work, how effective it is or isn't, how we can make it better, how we can, and also how we can stay engaged over time. It's been very inspiring.
All right, and let's go to Houston, Texas. Camille, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I just want to tell Dr. Farmer what an honor it is to hear him today. I'm a physician in Houston, and I've volunteered in Haiti a few times, and my husband has as well. And we're just so lucky to have him as an inspiration and a reminder of the important things in life. So thank you so much for all your hard work.
Wow, thank you, Camille, and thank you to your husband as well for, engaging our profession
and
in this work.
That reminds me, at you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, that reminds me to ask you, since you've been involved in this kind of work since age 23, what about your own personal life? Have you been able to have a personal life aside from your work?
Well, first of all, there's no prescription, I would say, for people involved in this work. In other words, there's all sorts of ways to be involved. I just had an email this morning, actually from Texas, from someone who had served with the U.S. military in Iraq, who's now planning to go into medicine and is asking the same question. And I don't think there's any one template. And in being a teacher and trainer of already now 20 years, a couple generations, that's one of the first things you need to explain, is that there's a lot of different ways of getting involved in this work. And sometimes you're lucky enough to have other people in your family, your spouse, your children involved in this work, your siblings. And other people don't have that good fortune, you know. And I'm lucky enough that my family is very committed to the same work or involved in it. And others, as I said, find that they can do this for this being the direct service delivery, for example, in a place like Haiti, Rwanda, or difficult settings in the United States. They don't want to do that full time, or they don't want to do that for 30 years or 20 years. That doesn't mean that all of us can't contribute very significantly. And so that's really the important lesson, I think, is that we can't conclude that there's just one way of doing this. It's not the same, for example, if you're a physician who's a young woman who has small children. It may be different because you're retired. It may be different because you're still a trainee. All along the way, there's got to be room for more than just the work itself.
And for you, has there been the opportunity to create a family, to and enjoy a personal life?
Sure, of course. And also, the aspiration, at least I hope, I'd love it if my children were involved in this work. But that is not for me to say. It's for them to decide. There's certainly a lot of time required to do this sort of work. I'm hoping, of course, in the future that it won't be so difficult to say healthcare for poor and vulnerable people has to be central to our society's activities. I'm hoping, reflecting back on your last show earlier today, that it won't be so hard to train and stipend community health workers, for example, for chronic care. It's been a real struggle, but there's so much progress that's being made on some fronts. For example, we have tools that were quite unimaginable when I started medical school 30 years ago. I'm hoping it'll be easier for the next generation to be involved in the manner they see fit.
Paul Farmer, he's co-founder of Partners in Health. He's chair of the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard University Medical School and author of To Repair the World. Paul Farmer speaks to the next generation, and former President Bill Clinton wrote the foreword to the book. Dr. Farmer, thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck in your work.
Thank you, Diane. It was a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Casey Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, and Danielle Knight. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Yerv-Lifker answers the phones.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive.